If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
It was the spring of 1992. My roommates and I were going on a weekend campout in the woods outside our town. Our roommate, Brock, who was in the military, had to stay at the base later than expected and said he would meet us there later tonight, which was unwelcome news for me and my other roommate, Cole. We had a big fight earlier that week where some long-held truths came out and truly hateful things were said that you couldn't just take back. We hadn't spoken since, and weren't even making eye contact, but reluctantly biting the bullet, and wound up carpooling. While giving my bags a final check, I heard Cole re-enter the house and head to his room. I took the opportunity to step outside and load my bags in the car. I got in the driver's seat and smoked a cigarette while waiting for Cole. He always moved at his own pace, and had no regard whatsoever for punctuality. I'm sure you know the type. His blatant disregard for timelessness was what I hated most about him, and actually caused our blowout. This situation was a classic example. I wanted to be on the road by 8, and here we were, 8:05, still idling in the driveway. A few more minutes passed before I saw Cole's red hoodie appear in my side-view mirror. I heard him put his bags in the trunk, after which he got into the passenger seat. Cole had his hood pulled up, arms tightly folded, and was turned towards the window, making a concerted effort to avoid so much as glancing in my direction. How petty, I thought, trying to keep my eyes fixed on the road, and acting like I didn't notice Cole's childish passive-aggressiveness. I still had a lot to get off my chest, and was dying to unleash it on him, but didn't want to start this weekend on a bitter note. He was already living rent-free in my head, I thought. Don't give him the satisfaction. Remarkably, we reached the campsite without even looking at each other or speaking. The campsite was situated right off a fire road along a small embankment that led to the river. We were about 2 miles into the forest, so it was a pretty secluded spot. Perfect in case we got a little too rowdy. We were meeting four of our other friends, Mason, Clark, Marvin, and Stephanie, who I was especially looking forward to seeing. We were getting close 4 years ago, before she left for grad school. She wound up living out there full-time, and apparently planned on staying permanently. I only found out the other day she moved back into town and would be at the campout this weekend. Although we hadn't spoken in a long time, I wanted to see if this reunion could rekindle some of the old magic we had years earlier. I could see the fire's glow, and everyone sitting around it as they reacted to my headlights illuminating the campsite. I pulled up and gave everyone a wave as they started heading towards my car. Soon as I brought my car to a halt, Cole threw the door open, stepped outside, and didn't even bother to shut it as he angrily stomped towards the river. I tried to show it didn't bother me, and was all smiles getting out of my car.
"I guess you two are still getting a divorce?"
Mason asked jokingly, as he walked up and gave me a quick high-five hug. I shrugged. "He'll get over it," I replied, before quickly changing the subject. I mentioned how Brock would be coming later tonight. There was only room for 2 cars, so he would have to park in a nearby lot and hike to the campsite. After greeting Clark and Marvin, the four of us chatted for a few minutes, before Marvin went to catch up with Chloe. I immediately noticed when Steph walked up to us, and we instantly locked eyes. She was a little thinner, and looked kind of worn or burnt out, but that doesn't make her any less beautiful. She still had that glowing aura, those same mysterious light green eyes, dark wavy hair, smooth, silky skin, and mesmerizing smile. We both gasped a breathy hi to each other, before awkwardly embracing. "You're back in town," I shakily uttered, clearly exhibiting my nervousness. Steph smiled and nodded.
"Yeah. Life's crazy sometimes," she replied. One minute, you've got everything going for you. Next, you're wondering how much lower than rock bottom you can go.
My eyes were drawn to Steph's bare arms, which had their fair share of cuts, scrapes, bruises, and what looked like puncture marks. I made no efforts to hide my staring at her arms and frowned. My reaction, though, was out of concern and not disgust or repulsion, which I think Steph sensed. "Everyone's got their demons," I said, smiling while lightly grabbing the tips of her hands. "And how we fight those battles is what I think defines us." Steph smirked.
"You were always so philosophical," she replied, giggling. "I never forgot that about you."
"Sounds like we got a lot to catch up on," I said, to which she nodded in agreement. Steph told me why she left Boston. Apparently, she developed some addicting habits. The lab she worked at manufactured her substance of choice, which she started stealing, and eventually got caught. The university didn't press charges, but kicked her out of the program. Steph said she's back home now, evaluating her options, finish her education, or accept a simpler, unescapable life in our hometown.
"That wasn't there last time we saw each other," I said, pointing above her left ankle, where just above it was a small, dark blue butterfly tattoo. "You were always so observant, too," she replied coyly.
"When'd you get that?" I asked, while shutting the car door that Cole left open.
"What's so fascinating about it?"
Steph quickly replied playfully. I kept looking to and from Steph's vibrant face and the butterfly tattoo. I found it rather provocative, like it signified a mysterious side of Stephanie she either developed while away or always had that I was just noticing. It was definitely a side to her that I wanted to explore more deeply. So this weekend was the perfect opportunity.
"So, you're not going to tell me?"
I asked, half-jokingly, while opening the trunk of my car. Then, Steph screamed. The sheer terror in her voice physically shook me, as Steph scrambled away from my car and frantically pointed at the trunk while falling into hysterics. When I looked to the trunk, my body completely froze. It felt like time stood still while I processed the grisly scene. Cole's nude body was curled up on top of our bags. His eyes were wide open and permanently frozen in an expression of utter shock. Cole's neck was completely mangled, from which blood was seeping and smeared across his limp body. In those first few seconds of seeing Cole's body, I was hit with a deep, unnerving revelation that made my stomach queasy and sent sharp chills down my spine. If this was Cole crammed in the truck, I thought, then who was in the car with me driving up? When I looked up from the trunk, I saw everyone had gathered around my car. Steph was still hysterical, while Mason and Clark nervously exchanged murmured whispers. The commotion even got Marvin's attention, who came back up from the river.
"What the fuck is this, Cooper?"
Marvin asked loudly upon seeing Cole's body.
"Cole's dead. What did you do to him?"
Marvin violently shook his hands while speaking, which made me notice something he was holding. Black sweatpants and a red hoodie. The same clothes whoever rode up here with me was wearing. I said nothing at first, especially after sensing the suspicion in Marvin's voice. He looked completely frazzled and was in a very standoffish pose, like he was trying to keep his distance. Everyone else looked familiar. I turned to Stephanie, who was backing up against a tree and sobbing uncontrollably. When our eyes met, the unfettered terror in her face led me to make an unsettling realization. It was me. They're all afraid of me. They think I did this to Cole.
"Wait," I said, slowly putting my hands up, which put everyone more on edge. "You think I actually did this to Cole?"
"Why shouldn't we?" Mason snapped back, who visibly displayed his sheathed knife. Given the circumstances, I knew the burden of proof was on me, and I had nothing to say that could absolve me on the spot.
I lowered my hands and kept them at my sides after Mason withdrew his knife. Mason was also in the military, and although he had no longer served, I didn't doubt his capabilities with a blade.
So, what are we going to do?
Marvin asked, while slowly helping Steph back to her feet.
Because there's someone else out there right now, so we have to do something quick.
Let's do this,
Mason said, after a few seconds of silence as he turned to Clark.
Why don't you take Steph into town and get help? Marvin.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
I'll stay here with Cooper.
You know I didn't do this to Cole,
I blurted. Mason looked at me sharply as everyone else headed towards Clark's truck.
Don't tell me what I know and don't know right now, Mason snapped back while pointing towards the tree line. What were you and whoever the fuck that was gonna do? Bury him out here? Throw him in the river? Were we supposed to be next? This is ridiculous,
I barked back, showing my frustration.
I don't know who this was. I don't know who that was. I was already in the car before Cole, that one person, even got in. I didn't even see him leave the house. We didn't say a word to each other the whole drive.
I got my first good look at Cole's body as Mason responded to my remarks. I noticed barbed wiring was tightly wrapped around his neck and dug deep into his flesh. The prospect of dying in such a horrific way sent sharp chills down my spine and made me wonder how close I may have been to suffering the same gruesome fate.
Answer me,
Mason barked loudly, snapping me out of my trance.
Did you guys plan this? Is this some sort of twisted game you sick fucks are playing?
Mason was relentless. Whether he was acting on instinct or out of fear, he had no doubt I killed Cole. I was guilty until proven innocent, and knew I needed something more than my words to get vindicated.
Wait,
I heard Steph say as she walked up to us, still sniffling and visibly shaken.
Cooper could be telling the truth.
Everyone stared, bewildered, at Steph.
If whoever killed Cole just threw his body in the trunk and had those clothes on before getting in the car with Cooper, if they weren't even talking, he could have pulled this off without Cooper noticing anything.
I nodded empathetically. We weren't even looking at each other, I quickly added. Nobody said anything for about a minute.
Fuck it, Mason finally said. Let's all get out of here. Take Cooper with us. There's four of us and one of him. We got numbers on our side.
Mason walked up, grabbed me by the collar, and pushed me back against my car.
If you look like you're even thinking about trying something,
Mason said fiercely as he pressed the tip of his knife against my neck.
I'll take you the fuck out. I don't know what this is, but I'm scared and not trying to die. Maybe you didn't do anything, but right now, the facts don't look good for you.
Mason made me walk in front of him and Steph, keeping my hands visible as we rejoined the others. Clark's truck was on, and he sat waiting for us in the driver's seat. Upon reaching the truck, Mason shoved me against it and thoroughly patted my pockets. After making sure I wasn't carrying anything dangerous, he grabbed me by my jacket and walked us around toward the driver's side.
Change of plans,
Mason said as he walked us up to Clark's rolled-down window.
We're all just gonna get out of here. We need to take Cooper, but we're watching him, so you don't have to worry. You cool with that?
But Clark didn't respond. His head was pulled back and held in place on the headrest by strands of barbed wire that were tightly wrapped around his bloodied head and neck. Like Cole, the barbs dug deep into Clark's skin, almost cutting completely through his neck in some spots. Clark's hands were completely mangled, clearly from struggling to try and get free. Steph started screaming again, but not from the sight of Clark's mangled body. She was reacting to something in the woods. As Steph started backtracking and frantically gesturing towards the tree line, I heard heavy, rhythmic footsteps coming from the direction she pointed, and could just make out a vague figure moving in the shadows. Steph bolted from the truck and blindly ran off into the forest. I looked back at Mason, who was just as terrified. I nudged Mason to snap him out of his shock, who looked at me with a frenzied expression.
"I don't know what this is,"
Mason gasped as he kept looking between me and the approaching figure.
"But I'm not fucking dying here."
I then felt a sharp pain just above my hip and fell to my knees as Mason quickly fled into the same direction as Steph. When I saw Mason had his blade out, I looked down at my hands that were pressed against where the pain came from and saw they were coated in blood. I had been stabbed, I realized. Mason stabbed me. The wounds didn't feel very deep, but was bleeding pretty bad, and hurt more with each passing second. I had no time to wallow over it, with the approaching figure's footsteps getting louder. Pressing one hand against the wound, I got back on my feet and staggered toward the general direction Steph and Mason fled. I wanted to make a break for my car, but wouldn't make it in time without being seen. I had two choices: hide out in the woods until the coast was clear, or head to the river, which was only a few hundred yards from our campsite, and follow it back to the main road. No sooner than I entered the tree line, however, I was bear-hugged by something that brought me to the ground. They placed one hand over my mouth and firmly held me in place behind a cluster of trees and brush.
"Shh," I heard Brock whisper. "Don't fucking move."
A wave of relief swept over me upon realizing it was Brock. Still pinned to the ground, I could see most of our campsite through a small opening behind our cover. I watched the figure exit the tree line and got my first ever glimpse of Wireface. He wasn't practically tall, maybe an inch or two under 6 feet. He had long, lanky arms and a slender but firm-looking physique. He wore a blue checkered plaid shirt, tattered gray overalls, along with thick, dark gloves and boots that were smeared with blood, dirt, and mud. He wore a beige burlap sack over his head, which was tightly wrapped in strands of barbed wire that had two small slits for him to see. Wireface slowly surveyed his surroundings before briefly re-entering the tree line. He pulled something squirming out of the forest and dragged it next to Clark's truck. It was Marvin. His hands and feet were hog-tied, and coils of barbed wire were tightly wrapped around his mouth. All he could do was writhe and make muffled cries that were well within earshot. Wireface grabbed a narrow metal pipe from the bed of Clark's truck and looked like he was debating what to do with Marvin. I feared the worst, but to my surprise, all Wireface did was set part of the pipe in the fire and re-enter the forest. Desperate to intervene, I tried wriggling free, but Brock kept me immobilized.
"Are you really that stupid?" he hissed in my ear. "That's exactly what he wants us to do. He's using Marvin as bait. We can't just leave him,"
I quickly replied, at a volume too loud for Brock's comfort, who clamped his hand over my mouth.
"Are you trying to get us killed?" Brock snapped back. "Stay the fuck quiet."
It was a waiting game. I felt just as helpless as Marvin, who could only move and twist on the ground. I don't know how long we stayed hunkered down, but enough time passed for me to notice the fire started dying.
"Who was that?"
I finally whispered to Brock, who soured at my ignorance.
"Come on, you've heard the stories,"
Brock quietly replied.
"Wireface. That's Wireface."
My jaw dropped. "As in Landry Danes?" Brock nodded.
"You all here tonight just got caught in the crossfire."
"What do you mean?" I asked, turning to face Brock. Brock sighed.
"It's me he's after."
To explain, Rock segued into telling Wireface's backstory. His name was Landry Danes, a local kid around our age who lived outside town. A few years ago, Landry was out here camping with friends. The details are sketchy, but he apparently got into some kind of scrum, during which he fell face first into the campfire. Nothing was ever proven, but there are whispers that Landry was deliberately tripped or pushed. Landry survived, but was hideously disfigured, and wore a burlap sack to hide his face. Some kids bullied him over this, and even made a game out of ripping the burlap sack off Landry's head to get a glimpse of his face. It drove Landry to wrap strands of barbed wire around his head, which is how he got his proverbial alias. Then, one night, Wireface attacked a group of kids in a nearby park. He didn't kill anybody, but apparently butchered one person so brutally they supposedly begged to be killed. Landry vanished that night and was never caught.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
He claims they didn't know where he was, but many suspected they were hiding him on their property. 2 years later, the Danes' home was destroyed in a fire. No remains were found, and the family was never seen again, except for Wireface. Since then, some around here claim they've encountered Wireface. He's been blamed for disappearances, cattle deaths, even property damage. But that was all speculation. Or so we thought. I was living out of state when all this happened, but hearing so many different versions of the story, I couldn't tell what parts were and weren't true. One part about it still didn't make sense. Even after hearing Brock's clarified rendition, I still didn't understand why Wireface would be hunting him down.
"This isn't the first time I've seen him," he whispered after a long, hesitant pause. "And I just knew, something was gonna happen tonight."
I narrowed my stare at Brock.
"What do you mean, you knew?" I asked sternly. "And you didn't say something?" "It's not that simple," Brock replied sharply. "Who would take me seriously?"
Before inquiring any further, I looked back at the campsite to get a visual on Marvin. He was still squirming, and his whimpers were compelling me to run out and save him, but Brock kept me in place. In retrospect, it's probably a good thing he did, because shortly after, Wireface reappeared. Marvin started twisting and whimpering, but Wireface paid no mind and walked right past him up to the campfire. He stared into the flames for a few moments, but retrieved the metal pipe he previously placed in the fire. My stomach knotted when I saw the pipe's glowing red tip, as Wireface turned towards Marvin. I made one last ditch effort to spring loose, but Brock kept me firmly in place.
"Just look away," Brock whispered. "There's nothing we can do for him."
My view was partially obstructed, but I still watched as Wireface stood over Marvin and stuck the metal pipe's glowing red tip in his eye. A crackly, high-pitched hiss rang out as Marvin began to thrash wildly and release a barrage of muffled, agonized screams. Wireface was twisting the pipe in his hands as he slowly pushed it deeper into Marvin's ocular cavity, clearly trying to prolong his death and inflict the most pain possible.
"Come on, we gotta go, now,"
Brock whispered as he pulled me away from watching the macabre scene.
"My truck's at the lot. We'll get there quicker if we follow the river. Steph and Mason are still out there,"
I replied, trying to ignore Marvin's muffled screams and pulsating pain that erupted from my stab wound when I began moving.
"I saw what Mason did to you," he replied. "They think you killed Cole. Do you trust them to trust you?"
I gave a weak nod as Brock started to pull me away,
and move deeper into the woods.
And with him poking around here,
Brock continued,
he'll get to us first before we find anyone. Let's just get help. Heck, maybe they wound up following the river too.
I reluctantly went along with Brock, who did make some good points. Maybe I should just worry about getting to safety at this point, I thought. Why go out of my way trying to save someone's life who just moments earlier showed he had no problem taking mine? These thoughts filled my head as we moved through the woods at a painstakingly slow pace. I guess, in some ways, that was good, because it kept the pain from my stab wound at ease. It felt like hours, but we finally heard the river's rushing water. I was eager to reach the riverbank, but Brock put a heavy hand on my shoulder.
We're not out of the woods yet, Brock said quietly. Short distances can be deceiving.
He pointed down a few feet in front of us, where the moonlight shone on a strand of barbed wire tied between two trees, just a few inches above the ground. Had Brock not pointed it out, I surely would have tripped over it and fallen into a few more strands of barbed wire that were set at varying heights in front of the tripwire. Before I could say anything, something grabbed Brock and spun him around just as I spotted its movement in the corner of my eye. It then got in between us and shoved me to the ground. I lay hunched over on my side, pressing my hand over the stab wound, but was quickly turned onto my backside and saw the tip of Mason's blade just inches from my face.
Mason, relax,
Brock said quickly, walking up to him and placing a hand on Mason's outstretched arm holding the knife.
He killed Cole,
Mason replied, keeping his eyes fixed on me, even while lowering his arm, holding the knife.
They gotta be in this together.
No,
Brock said softly.
He just used him to get to us.
Brock pulled Mason away, which gave me some time to get recollected and wait for the pain coming from my stab wound to subside. At first, all I heard were their whimpery murmurs, but then Brock and Mason began to argue. While trying to regain my composure, I only picked up a few phrases of their exchange. Brock telling Mason he didn't have to do that to me, and Mason saying something along the lines of he didn't know who to trust. While slowly sitting up, it was something Mason said to Brock.
We're here because of you.
That I found peculiar and caught my attention. I tried getting back on my feet, when something struck the side of my head that sent a sharp burning streaking across the left side of my face. The impact threw me back to the ground, from which I could feel, without having to see for myself, that blood was spilling from my face's left side. As my vision readjusted, while slowly sitting up, the first thing I saw was Wireface walk past me and close in on Brock and Mason. I didn't expect what happens next. As soon as Brock saw Wireface closing in, he grabbed Mason by the collar and practically threw him towards Wireface in a single motion before scurrying off into the woods. As he fled, Brock maniacally started screaming phrases like,
"Not me,"
and
"I'm not dying."
Mason practically stumbled into Wireface, but tried pushing himself off him and took a blind swing. Wireface effortlessly thwarted the attempted attack, grabbing Mason by his collar and headbutted him twice with his barbed wire face. The two strikes littered Mason's face with cuts and punctures that bled profusely. He seemed stunned by Wireface's two bashes, who then took his free hand, pressed it against Mason's face, and started violently twisting it in a grinding windshield wiper-like motion. Mason started screaming in sheer agony and wildly thrashed about, appearing totally helpless to break free of Wireface's grasp. I picked up sounds of ripping and scraping, which is when I realized the hand Wireface was mashing Mason's face with was wrapped in barbed wire. I watched in horror as Wireface then grabbed Mason's shirt with both his hands and threw him into the tripwire he set up, causing Mason to fall and get entangled in the other strands of barbed wiring he weaved in between the trees. Despite some blood getting in my eyes, I got back on my feet, right as Wireface began looking between me and Mason, whose body twisted and flailed as he released some of the most horrible, blood-curdling shrieks I've ever heard. How could Brock do that?
I thought, while waiting for my fight-or-flight instincts to kick in. They were best friends. I thought they'd both taken a bullet for each other without thinking twice. How could Brock turn on someone like that so quickly? He used them as their escape decoy. My train of thought was interrupted when Wireface began stepping in my direction. Fuck it, I thought, before turning and sprinting towards the river. Mason's screams persisted and rang throughout the woods as I ran, sending sharp chills down my spine and twisting my stomach into tight knots. Maybe Brock had the right idea. Why risk my life for someone who showed no regard for mine? Someone who literally stabbed me earlier tonight. And what about Brock? I thought. Can I even trust him after what he just did to Mason? Would he do the same to me if he had a chance? While contemplating these thoughts, I inadvertently stumbled down an embankment that brought me to the river, coming to a halt on the muddy bank. I lay semi-coiled in a ball, gritting my teeth from the sharp burning that came from the stab wound. After the pain became manageable, I slowly crawled towards the river shore to wash off my face. The left side burned when I applied water to it, and I could feel the lacerations Wireface made when he struck me with that same hand he wrapped in barbed wire. I was able to walk, but the pain coming from my stab wound every time I took a step or deep breath was excruciating. I didn't see any footprints along the riverbank, making me wonder what became of Brock. Stephanie was...
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key, and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Still out there, too, I thought. Should I go back and find her? The pulsating pain coming from my stab wound prompted me to quickly dismiss the thought. It started to rain. A light drizzle quickly turned into an all-out downpour. Despite being injured and soaked to the bone, I continued following the river and eventually reached the lot. I walked up to Brock's pickup, which was the only car in the lot, and peered inside to see it was unoccupied. Brock's truck was locked, so in light of the circumstances, I smashed the driver's window with a rock to get inside. I started feeling around the driver's side visor, where I knew Brock kept a spare key. After finding it and turning on the car, I caught a glimpse of myself in the rearview mirror. 3 deep gashes and about 6 puncture marks ran across the front and left side of my face. I was lucky to get away with just that, unable to even fathom those horrific ways the others met their demise. I brandished a few other scrapes, cuts, and bruises, but my biggest concern was the stab wound, which still seethed with pain. I sped out of the lot and onto the dirt road. It still downpoured, and even with the windshield wipers, was difficult to see clearly. While rounding a bend, I noticed something standing in the road. The flashes of its plaid and brownish-beige clothes were all I needed to know it was Wireface. Gripping the steering wheel, I didn't hesitate to stomp on the accelerator and plowed right into Wireface. His limp upper torso slammed on the truck's hood before getting sucked under and was turned into a speed bump. After feeling the entire car run over him, I slammed on the brakes and stared at Wireface's battered body through my side-view mirror. I waited several minutes before stepping out of the truck. I probably should have kept driving, but wanted to confirm he was actually dead. Another part of me hoped he was taking his last breaths so I could observe his final moments with my own eyes. There was a brown burlap sack over his head. He wore a tattered plaid shirt that was blue and green in color, along with dark gray overalls. His limbs were bent and twisted in different directions, which was when I noticed both his feet were missing. It looked like they were totally torn off his legs, and when I turned toward the spot where he stood, I saw 2 fleshy stumps protruding from a pair of shoes situated in the center of the road. Moving away from the body, I squinted in bewilderment as a strong uneasiness began to materialize. I realized tight strands of barbed wire ran across the road, and were tightly wrapped around the severed feet, holding them in place. One of them also had a subtle detail that made me begin to physically tremble. Just above the left foot's ankle was a small, dark blue butterfly tattoo.
"No, no, no, no,"
I muttered, feeling the panic unravel as I scrambled back towards the body and pulled the burlap sack off its head. My fears were confirmed when I found myself staring into Steph's lifeless eyes. The sight sent sharp pains shooting out of my stab wound as I fell to my knees and began sobbing Steph's name. Her mouth hung agape, like it was frozen mid-scream, as if trying to say, "Stop." "It was an accident," I thought. "Anybody else would have done the same thing. How could I have known? She looked just like him." That was when I noticed the clothes and burlap sack she wore. Although similar looking, didn't identically match Wireface's attire. There was nothing I could do now, I thought, and slowly stood back up, trying not to disturb my stab wound. I kissed my hand and was about to place it on Steph's forehead when I spotted something emerge from the tree line. It was Wireface. He just stood there in the pouring rain, seeming like he was both taunting me and lavishing over my reaction to running over Stephanie. A knotty queasiness formed in my stomach, and before he had a chance to get any closer, I listened to my instincts and scrambled back into Brock's truck. I caught one last fleeting image of Wireface in the rearview mirror, who stood alongside the road, canting his head and watching as I sped away in the pouring rain. The rest of the night was a blur. My stab wound was apparently much worse than I thought. I lost a lot of blood and had to be hospitalized. The police eventually cleared me as a suspect, but there were still a few on the force that weren't convinced. The police discovered 4 bodies and conducted a thorough sweep of the woods, but found no trace of our attackers. It wasn't in the official report, but the bodies were supposedly found seated around the campfire, held in upright, lifelike poses with an intricate entanglement of barbed wire. Circumstantially, the evidence was there, but police had nothing physical to officially declare these killings were the work of Landry Danes. I want to say this was my only encounter with Wireface. However, it's not where my story ends. Although I barely escaped being one of Wireface's first victims, it was unbeknownst to me that his reign of terror had only begun.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key, and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.